piano. He glanced at Longstreet, grinned vaguely, glanced away. We went over there for the last dinner together, night before we all broke up. Spring of 61. He paused, looked into the past, nodded to himself. Myra Hancock had us over. One more evening together. You remember Myra. Beautiful woman. Sweet woman. They were a beautiful couple, you know that? Most beautiful couple I ever saw. He sure looks like a soldier now, and that's a fact. Longstreet waited. Something was coming. Garnet was there that last night, and Sidney Johnston. Lot of fellas from the old outfit. We were leaving the next day. Some going north, some coming south. Splitting up. God, you remember. Longstreet remembered. A bright, cold day. A cold, cold day. A soldier's farewell. Goodbye, good luck, and see you in hell. Armstead said, We sat around the piano toward the end of the evening. You know how it was. Mary was playing. We sang all the good songs. That was one of them. Kathleen Mavourneen. And there was Mary of Argyle, and... It may be for years, and it may be forever. Never forget that. He stopped, paused, looked down into the whiskey glass, looked up at Longstreet. You know how it was, Pete. Longstreet nodded. Well, the man was a brother to me. You remember. Toward the end of the evening, it got rough. We all began, well, you know, there were a lot of tears. Armstead's voice wavered. He took a deep breath. Well, I was crying, and I went up to Wynne, and I took him by the shoulder, and I said, Wynne, so help me. If I ever lift a hand against you, may God strike me dead. Longstreet felt a cold shudder. He looked down at the ground. There was nothing to say. Armstead said, shaken, I've not seen him since. I haven't been on the same field with him, thank God. It troubles me to think on it. Longstreet wanted to reach out and touch him, but he went on looking at the dark ground. Can't leave the fight, of course, Armstead said. But I think about it. I meant it as a vow, you see. You understand, Pete? Sure. I thought about sitting this one out, but I don't think I can do that. I don't think that would be right either. Guess not. Armstead sighed. He drank the last of the whiskey in a swift single motion. He took off the soft black hat and held it in his hand, and the gray hair glistened wetly, and the band of white skin at the forehead shone in the light. With the hat off, he was older, much older. Old Courtly Lowe. Had been a fiery young man. Lothario. Grown old. Thank you, Pete. Armstead's voice was steady. Had to talk about that. Cause. I sent Myra Hancock a package to be opened in the event of my death. You'll drop by and see her? After this is done? Longstreet nodded. He said, I was just thinking of the time you hit early with the plate. Armstead grinned. Didn't hit him hard enough. Longstreet smiled. Then he was able to reach out and touch him. He just tapped him once lightly, one touch, on the shoulder, and pulled back his hand. Out in the camp, in the light of the fire, Pickett was winding down. He was telling the story about the time during a cannonade when there was only one tree to hide behind, and how the men kept forming behind the tree, a long, thin line which grew like a pigtail, and swayed to one side or the other every time a ball came close. and as Pickett acted it out daintily, gracefully, it was very funny. Armstead said, "Wonder if these cherry trees will grow at home. You think they'll grow at home?" In a moment, Armstead said, "Let's go join the party, Pete. Why not? Before they drink up all the whiskey." "No, thanks. You go on."
"Pete, tomorrow could be a long day."
"Work to do." But Longstreet felt himself yielding, softening, bending like a young tree in the wind. "Come on, Pete. One time. Do you good." Longstreet looked out at all the bright apple faces. He saw again in his mind the steady face of Lee. He thought, "I don't belong." But he wanted to join them. Not even to say anything, just to sit there and listen to the jokes up close, sit inside the warm ring, because off here at this distance with the deafness you never heard what they said, you were out of it. But if he joined, there would be a stiffness. He did not want to spoil their night. And yet suddenly, terribly, he wanted it again, the way it used to be. Arms linked together, all drunk and singing beautifully into the night, with visions of death from the afternoon, and dreams of death in the coming dawn, the night filled with a monstrous and temporary glittering joy. Fat moments, thick seconds dropping like warm rain, jewel after jewel. "Pete?" Longstreet looked up. He let go the reins of command. He thought of the three Union Corps, one of them Hancock, dug in on the hill, and he let them all go. He did not want to lead any more. He wanted to sit and drink and listen to stories. He said, "I guess one drink, if it's all right." Armstead took him by the arm with a broad grin, and it was genuine. He took Longstreet by the arm and pulled him toward the circle. "Hey, fellas," Armstead said, "look what I got. Make way for the old man." They all stood to greet him. He sat down and took a drink, and he did not think any more about the war. 6. Lee. He worked all that night. The noise went on around him until long after midnight. His staff was too small, must do something about that. But he could handle the work, and there were many decisions that could be made only by the commanding officer, and the commanding officer should know as much as possible about the logistics of the situation, the condition of the army, down to the last detail. He found that he could work right through the pain, that there came a second wind. If you sat quietly in a rocking chair, you could work all night long. The trouble came when you tried to move. So he worked from the chair, not rising, and every now and then he rested his head in his hands and closed his eyes and blanked the brain, and so rested. The noise did not bother him, but he did not like people crowding too close. After a while, he knew it was time to be alone. He told Taylor to ask the people outside to disperse. In a few moments it was very quiet. He rose up out of the chair and stepped out into the night. Time to make a plan now. Time to make a decision. The night air was soft and warm. Across the road there were still many fires in the field, but no more bands, no more singing. Men sat in quiet groups, talking the long, slow talk of night in camp at war. Many had gone to sleep. There were stars in the sky and a gorgeous white moon. The moon shone on the white cupola of the seminary across the road. Lovely view. Good place to see the fight. He had tried to climb the ladder, but it turned out not to be possible. Yet there was little pain now. Move slowly. Slowly. He said to Taylor, "What day is it now?" Taylor extracted a large, round watch. "Sir, it's long after midnight. It's already Friday."
Friday, July 3rd.
Yes, sir. I believe that is correct.
And tomorrow will be the 4th of July.
Sir?
Independence Day.
Taylor grunted, surprised.
I'd quite forgotten.
Curious coincidence, Lee thought.
Perhaps an omen?
Taylor said, The good Lord has a sense of humor.
Wouldn't it be ironic,
Lee could not resist the thought,
if we should gain our independence from them on their own Independence Day?
He shook his head, wondering. He believed in a purpose as surely as he believed that the stars above him were really there. He thought himself too dull to read God's plan, thought he was not meant to know God's plan, a servant only. And yet sometimes there were glimpses. To Taylor he said, I'll go sit with Traveler a while and think. You will keep these people away?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry to keep you so late.
My pleasure, sir.
We should have a larger staff.
Sir, I shall be offended.
Well, I want to think for a while. Alone.
Sir.
Lee moved off into the dark pasture. Now in motion he was aware of stiffness, of weakness, of a suspended fear. He moved as if his body was filled with cold cement that was slowly hardening. And yet there was something inside bright and hot and fearful, as if something somewhere could break at any moment, as if a rock in his chest was teetering and could come crashing down. He found the dark horse in the night and stood caressing the warm skin, thick, bristly mane, feeding sugar, talking.
Two alternatives. We move away to better ground, as Longstreet suggests, or we stay to the end.
He sat on a rail fence. And so we broke the vow. Longstreet's bitter phrase. It stuck in the mind like one of those spiny stickerburrs they had in the South, in Florida. Small, hooked seeds that lurk in the grass. Honest and stubborn man, Longstreet. We broke the vow. No point in thinking. He remembered the night in Arlington when the news came. Secession. He remembered a paneled wall and firelight. When we heard the news, we went into mourning. But outside there was cheering in the streets, bonfires of joy. They had their war at last. But where was there ever any choice? The sight of fire against wood paneling, a bonfire seen far off at night through a window, soft and sparky glows always to remind him of that embedded night when he found that he had no choice. The war had come. He was a member of the army that would march against his home, his sons. He was not only to serve in it, but actually to lead it, to make the plans and issue the orders to kill and burn and ruin. He could not do that. Each man would make his own decision, but Lee could not raise his hand against his own. And so what then? To stand by and watch, observer at the death? To do nothing? To wait until the war was over? And if so, from what vantage point and what distance? How far do you stand from the attack on your home, whatever the cause, so that you can bear it? It had nothing to do with causes. It was no longer a matter of vow. When Virginia left the Union, she bore his home away as surely as if she were a ship setting out to sea, and what was left behind on the shore was not his anymore. So it was no cause and no country he fought for, no ideal and no justice. He fought for his people, for the children and the kin, and not even the land. because not even the land was worth the war, but the people were. Wrong as they were, insane even as many of them were, they were his own. He belonged with his own. And so he took up arms willingly, knowingly, in perhaps the wrong cause against his own sacred oath, and stood now upon alien ground he had once sworn to defend, sworn in honor, and he had arrived there really in the hands of God without any choice at all. There had never been an alternative, except to run away, and he could not do that. But Longstreet was right, of course. He had broken the vow, and he would pay. He knew that, and accepted it. He had already paid. He closed his eyes. Dear God, let it end soon. Now he must focus his mind on the war. Alternatives? Any real choice here? Move on to higher ground in another place? Or stay and fight? Well, if we stay, we must fight. No waiting. We will never be stronger. They will be gaining men from all directions. Most of the men will be militia, not the match of our boys, but they will come in thousands, bringing fresh guns. Supplies will come to them in rivers, but nothing will come to us. Richmond has nothing to send. So if we stay, we fight soon. No more chance of surprise. No more need for speed or mobility. But no more delay. We cannot sit and wait. Bad effect on the troops. And if we pull out? He saw that in his mind's eye. His boys backing off, pulling out, looking up in wonder and rage at the Yankee troops still in possession of the high ground. If we fall back, we will have fought here for 2 days, and we will leave knowing that we did not drive them off. And if it was no defeat, surely it was no victory. And we have never yet left the enemy in command of the field. I never saw soldiers fight well after a retreat. We have always been outgunned. Our strength is in our pride. But they have good ground, and they have fought well on home ground. He saw a man coming toward him, easy gait, rolling and serene, instantly recognizable. Jeb Stuart. Lee stood up. This must be done. Stuart came up, saluted pleasantly, took off the plumed hat, and bowed.
You wish to see me, sir?
I asked to see you alone, Lee said quietly. I wish to speak with you alone, away from other officers. This has not been possible until now. I am sorry to keep you up so late.
Sir, I was not asleep,
Stuart drawled, smiled, gave the sunny impression that sleep held no importance, none at all. Lee thought, here's one with faith in himself, must protect that. And yet there's a lesson to be learned. He said, are you aware, General, that there are officers on my staff who have requested your court-martial? Stuart froze. His mouth hung open. He shook his head once quickly, then cocked it to one side. Lee said, I have not concurred, but it is the opinion of some excellent officers that you have let us all down.
General Lee,
Stuart was struggling. Lee thought, now there will be anger.
Sir,
Stuart said tightly,
if you will tell me who these gentlemen...
There will be none of that. Lee's voice was cold and sharp. He spoke as you speak to a child, a small child from a great height. There is no time for that.
I only ask that I be allowed...
Lee cut him off.
There is no time,
Lee said. He was not a man to speak this way to a brother officer, a fellow Virginian. He shocked Stuart to silence with the iciness of his voice. Stewart stood like a beggar, his hat in his hands.
"General Stewart," Lee said slowly, "you were the eyes of this army."
He paused.
Stewart said softly, a pathetic voice, "General Lee, if you please."
But Lee went on.
"You were my eyes. Your mission was to screen this army from the enemy cavalry and to report any movement by the enemy's main body. That mission was not fulfilled."
Stewart stood motionless.
Lee said, "You left this army without word of your movements or of the movements of the enemy for several days. We were forced into battle without adequate knowledge of the enemy's position or strength, without knowledge of the ground. It is only by God's grace that we have escaped disaster." "General Lee."
Stewart was in pain, and the old man felt pity. But this was necessary. It had to be done as a bad tooth has to be pulled, and there was no turning away. Yet even now he felt the pity rise, and he wanted to say, "It's all right, boy, it's all right. This is only a lesson. Just one painful, quick moment of learning. Over in a moment. Hold on. It'll be all right." His voice began to soften. He could not help it.
"It is possible that you misunderstood my orders. It is possible I did not make myself clear. Yet this must be clear. You with your cavalry are the eyes of the army. Without your cavalry, we are blind. And that has happened once, but must never happen again."
There was a moment of silence. It was done.
Lee wanted to reassure him, but he waited,
giving it time to sink in, to take effect, like medicine. Stewart stood breathing audibly. After a moment he reached down and unbuckled his sword theatrically and handed it over with high drama in his face. Lee grimaced, annoyed, put his hands behind his back, half-turned his face. Stewart was saying that since he no longer held the general's trust, but Lee interrupted with acid vigor.
"I have told you that there is no time for that. There is a fight tomorrow, and we need you. We need every man, God knows. You must take what I have told you and learn from it as a man does. There has been a mistake. It will not happen again. I know your quality. You are a good soldier. You are as good a cavalry officer as I have known, and your service to this army has been invaluable. I have learned to rely on your information. All your reports are always accurate. But no report is useful if it does not reach us. And that is what I wanted you to know. Now."
He lifted a hand. "Let us talk no more of this." Stewart stood there, sword in hand. Lee felt a vast pity. Yet at the same time he could feel the coming of a smile.
"Good thing it was dark."
He said formally, "General, this matter is concluded. There will be no further discussion of it. Good night." He turned away. Stewart stood holding the sword, but he had too much respect for Lee to speak. He began to move slowly away. Lee saw him stop before going back out into the night and put the sword back on.
"A good boy. If he is a man, he will learn.
But now he will be reckless to prove himself. Must be aware of that. Longstreet would not approve. But court-martial would have destroyed him. And he is spirited, and that is a great part of his value. Keep him on rein, but on a loose rein. He has to be checked now and then. But he's a fine boy, and I am sorry to have had to do that. Yet it was necessary." He sat back on the fence. Another figure was coming. He sighed, wanting silence. But the man was Venable, back from Ewell's camp. Like all of Lee's aides, he had had too much to do and had slept little in the last 2 days, and he was nearing exhaustion. He reported, speech blurred.
Sir, I think I've, pieced it together. I've been studying General Ewell's, operation. Regret to say, very strange. There is much confusion in that camp.
Is General Ewell in firm command? They had discussed it. Venable, who was fond of Dick Ewell, paused before answering. Then he said slowly,
Sir, I think General Ewell defers too much to General Early. He is uncertain.
I regret the necessity for speaking, sir. I would have preferred not.
I know. Lee bowed his head. So, the choice of Dick Ewell had been a mistake. But how was one to know? Honest old Baldy had been a fine soldier, but cannot command a corps. Could I have known? Who else was there? Dorsey Pender is wounded. Venable said, General Ewell could not get his corps in position for the attack this afternoon until some hours after Longstreet had already begun. General Rhodes got his men bottled up in the streets of Gettysburg and never attacked at all.
Not at all?
No, sir. General Early attacked at dusk.
At dusk?
But that was hours late.
Yes, sir. Longstreet's attack was virtually over before Early got into action. But Early made no progress and called off the attack very soon. General Johnson managed to capture some trenches. Casualties were, light.
Lee said nothing. He thought, Jackson would have moved. No time for that. He stared at the bold moon. You gave General Ewell my orders for the morning?
Yes, sir. He understands he is to be in position to attack at first light.
He understands that?
Yes, sir.
He will have all night to prepare. That should be nearly ample time. There was in Lee's voice a rare touch of bitterness. Venable paused warily, then said,
Are there any further orders, sir?
Not just yet. Lee rested against the rail fence. Cannot depend on Ewell, nor on Hill. There is only Longstreet. Pickett is fresh. Longstreet has fresh men, Virginians. For whom we broke the vow. Lee shook his head. Well, one thing is sure. If we attack tomorrow, it will be with Longstreet. He meditated a moment, weariness flowing through him like a bleak, slow wind.
Think now, before you get too tired.
He dismissed Venable and turned back to the night. He sat down once more against the rail fence. The horse moved in over him. He had to move to keep from being stepped on. He sat on the far side of the fence and reviewed the facts and made the decision. It did not take him very long. He was by nature a decisive man, and although this was one of the great decisions of his life, and he knew it, he made it quickly and did not agonize over it. He did not think of the men who would die. He had learned long ago not to do that. The men came here ready to die for what they believed in, for their homes and their honor. And although it was often a terrible death, it was always an honorable death. And no matter how bad the pain, it was only temporary. And after death, there was the reward. The decision was clear. It had been there in the back of his mind all that night as he worked, remembering every moment the sight of his blue Virginia flags going up that long slope to the top, almost to victory. So close he could feel the world over there beginning to give like a rotten brick wall. He could not retreat now. It might be the clever thing to do, but cleverness did not win victories. The bright combinations rarely worked. You won because the men thought they would win. attacked with courage, attacked with faith. And it was the faith more than anything else you had to protect. That was the one thing that was in your hands. And so you could not ask them to leave the field to the enemy. And even if you could do that, cleverly, there was no certainty they would find better ground anywhere else, not even certainty that they could extricate themselves without trouble. And so he had known all along that retreat was simply no longer an alternative. The way a man of honor knows that when he has faced an enemy and exchanged one round of blows and stands there bleeding and sees the blood of the enemy, a man of honor can no longer turn away. So he would stay. And therefore he would attack. The rest was clear as an engraving, so natural there seemed no alternative. There would be no surprise now. Speed no longer mattered. So motion meant nothing. The enemy had been attacked on both wings. He had reinforced there and would be strongest there. So the weak point was the center. The enemy had high ground on each wing, but in the center there was a long slope, so he would be softest there. And if you hit him there with everything you had, all the artillery firing to prepare the way in a pont-à-feu, if you sent Pickett's fresh Virginian straight up the center, with Longstreet's hand the guiding force, the dominant force, you would drive a split in the center and cut Meade's army in two, break the rotten wall, and send the broken pieces flying in all directions, so that if you sent Stuart's cavalry around to the rear, he could complete the rout, in among the wagons to finish the wreckage. Yes, Stuart raw with wounded pride and so anxious to redeem himself that he would let nothing stop him, and neither would Pickett, who had come in that day so desperately eager for battle. Lee knelt and began to pray. His engineer's mind went on thinking while he prayed. He could find no flaw. We will go up the center and split them in two, on the defense no longer, attacking at last, Pickett and Hood and McLaws. By the end of the prayer, he was certain. He felt a releasing thrill. This was the way, as God would have it. Face to face with the enemy, on grounds of his own choosing. End with honor. The weight of it was gone. He felt a grave drowsiness. The horse nuzzled his ear. He smiled and rubbed the delicate nostrils. Then he began to drift off. He should go into bed now. But he was not comfortable lying down. He could not breathe. It was far better to sit in the night alone with the beautiful horse standing guard above him. It was not so bad to be an old man, drifting. Soon to see the light. He wondered what it would be like to enter the presence. They said there would be a fierce, blinding light. How could they know, any of them? He wondered. Do you see all the old friends? At what age will they be? Will I see my father? But it was all beyond him, and he accepted it. He had done his best. The Lord knew it. The heart thumped twice, a grave reminder. Lee nodded, as if at a summons, and prayed to the Lord for a little more time. After a while he slept. He dreamed of little girls dancing a cotillion. Then he dreamed of horses, herds of great horses, thundering by through black canyons of cloud. Beyond his tree as he slept, the first blood light of dawn was rising up the sky. Friday, July 3, 1863. Of his terrible swift sword. 1. Chamberlain. At dawn he climbed a tree and watched the day come. He was high on the summit of Round Top, higher than any man in either army. The sky was thick and gray, smelling of heat and rain. Long mists drifted down between the ridges, lay in pools in the woods, rose toward the sun like white steam. He could see campfires burning in groups and clusters, like little cities sparkling in the mist, far, far off toward the blue hills to the east. He could look directly down on the gray crest of Little Round Top, saw the gunners there rising and stretching and heating coffee near Black Cannon. There were lights all down the Union line, a few horses moving, here and there a bugle, lights in the cemetery, a spattering of lights in Gettysburg. Here at the summit of Round Top the air was cool, there was no wind. The odor of death was very slight, just that one pale yellow scent, a memory in the silent air. The odor of coffee was stronger. Chamberlain sniffed and hoped, but he had none. All the rations were gone. He lay back and watched the morning come. The men lay below him in a line below the crest, receding down into the trees, the dark. In the night they had built a stone wall, had set out pickets, and taken prisoners. They had been joined at last by the 83rd Pennsylvania and the 44th New York, but they were still the extreme end of the Union line, the highest point on the field. Chamberlain kept pickets out all night, changing them every 2 hours, making them report every half hour. He did not sleep. As long as he kept moving, the pain in the leg did not trouble him, but the foot kept bleeding and annoying him. No one had any rations. They had left Union Mills with 3 days' worth, but the troops had philosophically eaten most of that first chance they got. Chamberlain searched for coffee, which he badly needed. Just before sunup, he began to get very, very tired, and so he climbed the tree and rested his legs. Dawn was always the worst time. Almost impossible to keep the eyes open. Closed them, and he thought of her, the red robe. This morning, oddly, he thought of her and of his 2 children. He could see them clearly when he closed his eyes, playing at her feet like cubs, she looking up at him smiling calmly, waiting, pouting. But they would not even be up yet, too early for them. They will sleep 2 more hours at least. And here I sit on a hill in Pennsylvania, high on a hill perched in a tree, watching the dawn come. A year ago I was in Maine, a teacher of languages. Amazing. The ways of God. Who would have thought? Well, it will be hard to go home again after this. Yesterday was... He closed his eyes. Saw the men behind the rocks, Tozier with the flag, the smoke, white faces, a scream for bayonets. Yesterday was a dream. He almost dozed, came awake. Needs someone to talk to. Sky all thick and gray. Rain? I hope so. But no, another scorcher. They don't even know about this kind of weather back in Maine. Colonel! At the foot of the tree, Tom. Chamberlain smiled. Hey, Colonel! I got you some coffee. He held aloft a steaming cup. Chamberlain's stomach twinged in anticipation. Tom clambered up, reaching. Chamberlain took the hot cup, held it lovingly. Oh, that's fine. Where did you find that? Well, Tom grinned. Gee, you sure can't see a ways from up here, he squinted. Golly, that's the whole damn Reb Army. Don't swear, Chamberlain said automatically. He thought of yesterday. I used him to plug a hole. My brother. Did it automatically, as if he was expendable. Reached out and put him there. As you move a chess piece. We sent out a detail, Tom said cheerily, yawning, and found some poor departed souls down there, and they were carrying coffee for which they had no more use. So we took it. Chamberlain grimaced. Ghoul, he said. But he drank. and the coffee was sweet with brown sugar, and strength boiled into him.
"How you feel, Colonel, sir?
You notice I don't say Lawrence.
I feel fine. You know, I bet we're higher than anybody in the whole army, in both blame armies."
Tom was pleased.
"Now there's a thing to tell you, children. My, what a view."
Chamberlain drank. After a moment he said, without thinking, "I miss old Buster."
"Kilrain?"
"Yep. But he'll be all right." The vacancy was there. A hole in the air. A special kind of loneliness. You wanted to have Buster to talk to when it was all over. To go over it. To learn. To understand. To see what you should have done. Tom said, "You know, Lawrence, I close my eyes, I fall asleep."
"Better get down off the tree."
"You know what?"
"What?"
"I don't like bayonets." He squinted at Chamberlain, shrugged foolishly, blinked and yawned. "One thing about war I just don't like. Different, you know? Not like guns and cannon. Other men feel same way. You know what I mean?"
Chamberlain nodded.
"I couldn't use mine," Tom said ashamedly. "Yesterday. Just couldn't. Ran down the hill, yelling, screamed my head off. Hit one man with the rifle barrel, bent the rifle all to hell. Pardon me. But couldn't stick nobody. Didn't see much of that either. I'm glad to say, most men won't stick people. When I was going back and looking at the dead, weren't many killed by a bayonet."
Chamberlain said, "Nothing to be ashamed of."
"Lawrence?" Chamberlain turned. Tom was gazing at him, owl-eyed. "You weren't afraid, much, yesterday?"
"Too busy," Chamberlain said.
"No," Tom shook his head. "I shoot and run around and all the time I'm scared, Green. But you weren't scared at all. Not at all."
"But at Fredericksburg you were scared."
Chamberlain said,
"I was too busy. Had things to do. Couldn't think about getting hurt."
But he remembered. There was more to it than that. There was an exultation, a huge delight. I was alive.
"Well," Tom said stubbornly, "you did real good." It was the old family expression, used by one brother to another down the years. "Did I do good?" "You did real good." Chamberlain grinned.
"You know what?" Tom said. He grabbed a branch, swung himself into a better position. "I think we're going to win this war." He looked to Chamberlain for confirmation. Chamberlain nodded, but he was too tired to think about it. All those noble ideals, all true, all high and golden in the mind. But he was just too tired, and he had no need to talk about it. He would hang on to these rocks, all right, of that he was certain. But he didn't know about another charge. He looked down on the men, the line running down the hill. "A little ammunition, a little food. We'll hang on to these rocks, all right. Now, if I could just get a little sleep."
"Lawrence, the way them Rebs kept coming yesterday, you got to admire 'em."
"Hmm," Chamberlain said.
"You think they'll come again today?"
Chamberlain looked out across the open air, gazed at the miles of campfires. "Doesn't look like they're planning to depart.
You think they'll come again?"
"They'll come again," he said. He stirred himself on the branch. "They'll come again for sure. Must get more ammunition up here. What in God's name is keeping Rice?"
"We only got about 200 men," Tom said thoughtfully.
Not with worry, but with calculation. A new realist, assessing the cold truth. "But the position is very good," Chamberlain said.
"I guess so," Tom admitted.
Rumble of cannon. At first he thought it was thunder, out of the dark sky to the north. But he saw the flashes sparkle on Cemetery Hill and knew it was too early for thunder. And as he looked northward, he could see sunlight breaking through the overcast to the north and west, and shells falling on the far side of the cemetery. He put his glasses to his eyes and looked, but all he could see was smoke and mist, an occasional yellow flash. Below him, on the hilltop, the heads of the men turned north. Chamberlain thought, diversion. To Tom, he said, you go down and alert the pickets. Maybe a diversion on that flank. They may be coming this way again. Send Rule Thomas to me. Tell him to send out another call to Rice for ammunition. Tom started down the tree. He scratched himself, swore feebly. Lawrence, we're going to need another runner, sir, old brother. I go up and down this hill much more. My leg's going to fall off. Chamberlain said, yes, tell Ellis Spear to pick a man. Send him to me. Tom moved down into the dark. Chamberlain waited in the tree. It was a very good position. The hill was flat across the top, about 30 yards of flat rock, an occasional tree, but the ascent on all sides was steep. The ground facing the enemy was rocky and steep and heavy with trees, and the ground behind him fell away abruptly, a sheer drop of at least 100 feet. No worry about assault from that side. The men had built another rock wall, and now, with enough ammunition, he could hold here for a long time. The end of the line. Overlooking all the world. They'll come again. Let 'em come. He half expected another assault, but there was no sound from below. The sky was brighter now, breaks in the overcast. Light streamed down in blinding rays. He shaded sleep-filled eyes, gazed out across the southern lines to the blue hills to the east. Lovely country. If I close my eyes, you know, I'll go to sleep. If they come again, could use some rest first. He heard a man snoring loudly just below his tree. He saw a round face, bearded, mouth open, flat on his back on a rock ledge, hands folded on his chest. Chamberlain smiled in envy. He thought, guess I'd better get down from here, look around. But now he had sat for a long time and his leg had stiffened. There was a brutal pain in his foot. He limped along the rock, trying to work out the stiffness. 34 years old, laddie, not the man you used to be. He walked painfully past the sleeping man. A tall, thin boy grinned happily upward, touched his cap. Chamberlain said, good morning. Colonel, sir. How are you getting along?
Hungry, sir.
The boy started to get up. Chamberlain held out a hand. Never mind that. Take it easy. He looked down on the round-faced sleeper, smiled.
Jonas can sleep anywhere, the boy said proudly.
Chamberlain moved on down the line. The battle in the north was growing. No diversion. Well, he felt oddly disappointed. Then a trace of pride. They tried this flank yesterday and couldn't move us. Now they're trying the other flank. He wondered who his opposite number was, the colonel on the far right, the last man on the right of the Union line. What troops did he lead? What was he thinking now? Good luck to you, Colonel, Chamberlain said silently, saluting in his mind. But you don't have soldiers like these. He limped among the men, passing each one like a warming fire. He shared with them all the memory of yesterday. He had been with them to that other world. They were in it now, the high, clear world of the last man in line, and all the enemy coming. Tozier on the rock with the flag in his hand, Tom plugging the gap, bayonets lifted, that last wild charge. He looked down, smiling as he passed, patting shoulders, concerned with small wounds. One boy lay behind a rock. He had been shot through the cheek yesterday, but had not gone to the rear, had charged, had come all this way to the top of the hill. Now he was down with a fever, and the wound in his face was inflamed. Chamberlain ordered him to the field hospital. There were several signs of sickness, one possible case of typhoid. Nothing to do but detail the men down the hill. But none of them wanted to go. Some deathly afraid of the hospital itself, some not wanting to be away from the men they knew. Men they could trust. The regiment of home. Chamberlain began to grow restless for food. He thought, "We're forgotten up here. Nobody knows what these men did yesterday. They saved the whole line, God knows, and now I can't even feed them." He was becoming angry. He clambered back up the hill and tore open the wound inside his boot, which began again to bleed. He sat down at the top of the hill, listening to the cannon fire and musketry raging in the north, momentarily grateful that it was over there, and took off the boot, bound the foot. Wished he could get something to wash it down with, but what water there was dirty and bloody. There was a creek down below, Plum Run, choked with yesterday's dead. Good to be up high, up here. The smells of death don't seem to be rising. Wind still from the south, blowing it away. You know, the regiment is weary. That thought had taken a while to form, had formed slowly as he moved up and down the line. Just so far you can push a man. He thought, a little food, a little rest. They'll be right again in a bit. Fewer than 200 now. And there on the rock, sitting, staring down at the long line of dark men shapeless under dark trees, he felt for the first time the sense of the coming end. They were dwindling away like sands in a glass. How long does it go on? Each one becoming more precious. What's left now is the best. Each man a rock. But now there are so few. We began with 1,000 and so whittled down, polishing, pruning, until what we had yesterday was superb, absolutely superb. And now only about 200. And God, had it not been for those boys from the 2nd Maine. But the end is in sight. Another day like yesterday, and the regiment will be gone. In the Union Army, that was the way it was. They fought a unit until it bled to death. There were no replacements. He shook his head, trying to shake away the thought. He could not imagine them gone. He would go with them. But if the war went on much longer, if there was one more fight like yesterday... The sound of the battle in the north grew steadily in intensity. Chamberlain, alone, wished he knew anything at all about what was happening. He could not even talk to Ellis Spear, who was down in the woods with the other flank of the regiment, where it joined the 83rd. He waited, alone, staying awake, listening. After a while, there was a courier from Rice. He saw a puffing lieutenant staggering up among the rocks. "Colonel Chamberlain!" "Sir, that's some climb." The lieutenant paused to gasp for air, leaned upon a tree. "My men need rations, Lieutenant," Chamberlain said. He stood up on his bloody foot, boot in hand. "Sir, Colonel Rice instructs me to tell you that you are relieved, sir." "Relieved?" Men were gathering around him. Sergeant Tozier had come up, that big-nosed man, towered over the lieutenant, gloomed down at him. "Colonel Fisher's people are coming up, sir, and will take over here. Colonel Rice informs me that he wishes to compliment you on a job well done and give your people a rest, so he wants you to fall back, and I am to show you the way." "Fall back." Chamberlain turned, looked around the hilltop. He did not want to go. You could defend this place against an army. Well, he looked at his tree, from which he had watched the dawn. He gave the word to Tozier. The 20th Maine would stay in position until Fisher's brigade came up. But in a few moments he heard them coming. Extraordinary. He had not expected anything quick to happen in this army. The lieutenant sat against a tree while Chamberlain moved among the troops, getting them ready to move. Chamberlain came back for one last look around. For a moment, at least, we were the flank of the army. From this point you could see the whole battlefield. Now they were going down to blend into the mass below. He looked around. He would remember the spot. He would be back here, someday, after the war. The men were in line all down the hill. Tom and Ellis Spear were waiting down below.
"You'll guide us, Lieutenant?"
"Yes, sir."
The lieutenant moved off, downward into the dark. Chamberlain said,
"I'll be wanting to go back to Little Round Top as soon as possible. The regiment will bury its own dead."
"Yes, sir. But I'm to lead you to your new position first, sir, if you don't mind."
Chamberlain said,
"Where are we going?"
"Oh, sir," the lieutenant grinned. "A lovely spot. Safest place on the battlefield. Right smack dab in the center of the line. Very quiet there."
2. Longstreet. Gorey was back in the gray dawn. The move to the south was still possible. The road to Washington was still open. But Union cavalry was closing in around Longstreet's flank. He sent orders to extend Hood's division. He sat in the gray light studying Gorey's map, smelling rain, thinking that a little rain now would be marvelous. Cool them. Cool the battle fever. Settle the dust. Wet mist flowed softly by. Dew dripped from the leaves, pattered in the woods. But the morning was already warm. The heat would come again. He drank coffee alone, dreaming. Scheibert, the Prussian, chatted with him about the Battle of Solferino. Longstreet could hear the laughter from Pickett's boys. Some of them had been up all night. They were moving into line in the fields behind Seminary Ridge, out of the sight of the Union guns. He was curt with Scheibert. The Prussian was not a fool. He bowed, departed. Longstreet studied the map. Rain would be a great blessing. Rain would screen our movements. Lee came out of the mists. He was tall and gray on that marvelous horse, riding majestically forward in the gray light of morning, outlined against the sky, the staff all around him and behind him, Lee alone in the center, larger than them all, erect, soldierly, gazing eastward toward the enemy line. He rode up, saluted grandly. Longstreet rose. Lee rested both hands on the pommel of his saddle. The mist thickened and blew between them. There was a ghostly quality in the look of him. Of all his staff, ghost riders out of the past, sabers clanking, horses breathing thick and heavy in the thick, dank air. Lee said, "General, good morning." Longstreet ordered him coffee. Lee declined. He said, "If you will mount up, General, I would like to ride over in that direction," he gestured eastward, "some little way." Longstreet called for his horse, mounted. He said,
"I've had scouts out all night, General. I know the terrain now."
Lee said nothing. They rode toward the high ground and opening in the trees. Longstreet looked out across a flat field of mist, fence posts, a ridge of stone black against the soft white flow of mist, then across the road and up the long rise toward the Union defenses, high out of the mist, fires burning, black cannon in plain view. Longstreet said again,
"Sir, I've discovered a way south that seems promising. If we would move..."
"General, the enemy is there." Lee lifted his arm, pointed up the ridge in a massive gesture. "And there's where I'm going to strike him." He turned and looked back at Longstreet for one long moment, straight into his eyes, fixing Longstreet with the black stare, the eyes of the general, and then turned away. Longstreet drew his head in, like a turtle. Lee said slowly, face to the east, "The situation is basically unchanged. But you have Pickett now, and he is fresh. I want you to move your corps forward and take those heights in the center and split the Union line." Longstreet took a deep breath. Lee said, "I have sent word to Ewell. He is to attack when you do, keeping the enemy pinned on that flank. Yours will be the main effort. Hill will be the reserve. You will have all our artillery preceding you fixed on that one point. A pointe-à-feu. He was watching Longstreet's face, gazing at him without expression, the eyes set far back under white brows, dark, touched with the cool light of the morning.